Good afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
Well, Bill, what do you have for us?
Well, Aaron, you know what? We have a sponsor this hour, Pape Machinery. They're our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. And Pape handles everything, tractors, implements, mowers, you name it. Go up and see them. They've got a pretty good inventory right now. They also do full parts and service. So if you've got an older machine you need to get fixed up, give them a call. Their phone number is 226-9226. And they're at, did I say they were at 3119?
Twinview Boulevard?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Okay, I just did again. Yeah. Or you can get them on the web at
3119 Twinview Boulevard?
No.
Oh, no, not that.
No, not that. We already did that three times. Their website is papemachinery.com.
I couldn't resist.
Yeah, we'll have to redo that whole thing top of the hour.
Yeah, next week. We're going to redo it next week on Sunday, probably right around noon.
Yeah.
12:05.
Okay.
Hey, and so, you know, you might want to get, you guys have steel products, which some of those are gas-powered. You might want to tell people about.
Yeah, I guess California is going to ban all the gas-powered stuff. So, you know, if you want a gas-powered...
Like weed whackers and...
Weed whackers, trimmers, chainsaws, riding mowers, all that stuff is going to be unable to retail in California. I think it's 2023 is when they're trying to do away with all that. I know in San Francisco and I think
Unless
Napa,
we can do away with all that.
Yeah. San Francisco and Napa have already... past ordinances where you can't, everything has to be electric. It's clean.
Because electric just comes from,
It just comes out of the wall.
Yep.
Yeah,
That's it.
Yeah, there's no fossil fuels used in the production of this electricity.
Yeah. Oh, Lord. Where do we find these people and how do we get rid of them?
I don't know.
For the people who are in California, I know we have a lot of people who are not in California, but if you are, you're, big chance here is September 14th. Make sure you, if you are in a fire zone, for instance, and your mail is all over the place, just go to your county clerk, have your ballot canceled and reissued. They can do that for you. So there is, for all the people panicking that, the folks that got relocated or burned out won't be able to vote, they absolutely will be able to vote. On the recall of Gavin Newsom, not to put too fine a point on it, but that is what it is for. It's
and
the
you
recall
might want
of Gavin
take
Newsom.
Take your ballot right to the ballot drop-off area because I guess felons have been found with carloads of ballots.
No.
Oh, yeah, only in California.
And there's a whole big thing about the envelopes that have the ballot envelopes have like a hole punch that goes through the whole envelope so that they can tell by just looking at it if it has a ballot in there or not to make sure none of them get left. It's not anything nefarious. It's just
you can't tell how you voted by looking through the hole.
Right. So apparently two of the 58 counties, maybe three, in California, if you put the ballot in one direction and you voted yes on the recall, you can see the yes check mark through the hole, but the vast majority of the counties do not have that.
Ours was not like that.
I tried.
I did. I folded mine four times couldn't get it lined up with the hole.
Yeah, Bill's over there doing origami. No.
Nope, that won't work. Unfold.
They'll never know how I voted.
I did a nice swan, though.
I do want you to know I dropped it off, by the way. Got that all handled. So anyway, just make sure you do that, and it's the end of August. What is today? August 29th. 2021, in case we re-air this show. So if you hear this at some other time and you're going, what recall? Sorry. It has come and it is gone.
That's what Gavin said.
Exactly. God, don't you hope. So I got a call from this lady last week. And all of a sudden she was talking about all this really interesting stuff. And I thought the same thing I always think. This is horrible. I'm the only person hearing all of this. I asked her, I said, so are you free on Sunday? Because maybe you could tell me all this while other people could hear about it, too, because it was really different. I told Bill, I go, hey, we're doing a show on concrete.
Oh, good.
And he's like,
I've been lousy. I can't trowel concrete worth a darn, and so I'm hoping maybe she can help me with some technique.
Yeah, we're going to do that over the radio.
Yeah.
Everyone just change the channel. Anyway, really interesting. And so, honestly, it's... I titled the show kind of what I wound up walking away with. You know, what do military veterans, infrastructure, specifically concrete, and national parks have in common? And the answer is
Tonya Wattenberg.
Tonya Wattenberg Comas. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And then She said, my dad did radio. And I was like, wait a minute, Bill Wattenberg? Like the KGO guy? Well, as a matter of fact, that happened to be your dad. So just a lot of fun coincidences. And before we bring her on, I was reading a little bit about him. And it was very, very interesting. It's the little blurb I found on some, I guess it was the Daily Post here. It said, on his show, Wattenberg answered questions about everything from car repairs to physics and would often help kids who called in with homework questions. While kind to children, Dr. Bill had a gruff, a suffer-no-fools attitude with grown-ups. He advocated for nuclear energy, criticized the Sierra Club. I was pretty happy right there. And argued that failure to clear the high country underbrush would lead to massive wildfires.
It was imagine
that.
Yeah.
Tanya was calling me specifically about Greenville, California, the little town that basically in majority burned down, because she had some ideas on how to fix it. And I thought, what an interesting world we live in.
Yeah.
So, Tanya, thank you for taking time out from moving your son to or from college.
To college. And I apologize for that helicopter that just went over.
Oh, I missed it. I missed the helicopter, okay. But I was at a fire meeting yesterday and it was all full of helicopters. So I think we all hear helicopters in our in the back of our mind now.
Yeah.
Well, I don't even know where to begin other than my burning question. I guess I should give a little blurb of your bio because it's pretty striking. I started reading. I'm like, wow.
Okay.
Wow. I'm not going to make you do it because it kind of sounds like that.
You didn't know how exciting concrete could be, did you?
I had no idea. I'm like, you're kidding me. She's like, oh, I'm in concrete preservation. I was like, okay. I was sort of stumped at that point, but apparently you are one of the five most influential people in the concrete industry in 2013 as rated by Concrete Construction Magazine. You have a PhD in architecture from Texas A&M, Master of Science in Historic Preservation from Columbia in New York, bachelor's in landscape architecture from the University of California, Davis. I have an English degree from Humboldt State, so, you know, don't try to fool me.
I'm going to pull it over your eyes,
Bill
that's
went
for sure.
To Butte, so. But we're snarky. They didn't trade that out of us. So you are actually the founding director and CEO of CPI, which is the Concrete Preservation. I always get this wrong.
Institute.
Preservation Institute Foundation. I always want to call it the foundation, but Institute goes first. Which is super interesting. It's an official U.S. military career skills program for active duty military and partner of the U.S. National Park Service at Alcatraz Island and Pearl Harbor, restoring landmark structures and training service members for civilian careers. I thought, how great is that? Everybody says, how come nobody cares about our veterans? Well, you're married to an Army veteran, and obviously you do care about them a lot. You're also a professor emeritus at the California State University Chico, which is probably why you're down there. College of Engineering, so that's cool. Research and projects with NASA for CO2 reduction and durable cement development. I don't know what that is, but we'd like to know. And nationwide industry certification for concrete repair. I'm looking at all this. You've been in Normandy, the landing site at Normandy. You've had appearances on History, Discovery, American, and the American Heroes Channel, which used to be the Military Channel. I think we all still call it the Military Channel. And technical structure and infrastructure advisor for the studios. So I'm guessing we're talking movie studios?
For the
yoga
studio
channel.
History Channel.
Okay. Well, okay.
On
so
one particular show. I don't span their entire network.
Okay. Well, yeah, I don't think anybody can. They're on like 9,000 channels. Every time I turn it on, it's some other channel. They're starting to turn into like the news or the sports thing. Yeah, ESPN 1 through 99. Okay, so you're a little girl and you're growing up and you lived in Greenville or near Greenville.
And we had forest fires all the time, right?
Yeah.
You know, so let me give you the three things I think to give everyone a sense of where I'm going with some of what I want to talk about.
Absolutely.
First of all, passion and anger over the Dixie Fire. We kind of covered some of my qualifications, which we'll talk about, the nonprofit foundation that I developed and run. And then I think most importantly is there are some specific solutions. Not a lot of whining here. I want to just present some very specific solutions that we that could help not only the natural resources in the forest, but, you know, my work is more in the national parks with cultural resources, meaning the things that people built versus natural. So I want to talk about the Dixie Fire and the personal impact, me, my family, everybody else, you know, not just in Greenville, but, you know, Canyon Dam is gone and other towns are threatened, and next year it will be other towns, right?
Absolutely.
You know, as a child, we lived in these old wooden structures way up on the town on the mountain outside of town. And, you know, I always remember helicopters going over and my uncle or my brother hopping on a bulldozer. There were three lumber mills in Indian Valley at that time. When there were fires, the forests were well managed. You know, the people who owned those logging companies had a stake in healthy forests. There were people there. There were resources there. So whether it was a Forest Service working with the local community, fires then were a natural thing. The forests were cleared, and we all felt safe. It never crossed our mind that something like this could happen. But, you know, mid-'80s, when all the logging industry died, and I'm not an expert on all of that, but I do remember mention of a spotted owl multiple times. You know, when those forests became unmanaged, or maybe some people in Washington, D.C. feel like they are managing them, you know, I am certainly not an expert on climate change. You know, maybe the world is getting warmer, but we've had ice ages and melting of ice ages in the history of this planet, so I'm not going to go into why at all. I don't know on the climate change part of it, but maybe it is hotter. Maybe we are a little bit drier. But that does not excuse the mismanagement.
Exactly.
You know, I'll tell you what, you know, one of the guys that lives up near us took all of his things just a few weeks as the fire was raging down into town. It was like, we knew the risk of living up on the mountain in the trees, and we cleared, and like you mentioned, my father said, my brother and sister and I walked around up in the woods a week ago, and the fire did not burn our place. Miraculously.
Wow.
But the clearing had been done.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of property up on the mountain. We had done the clearing over the years, the selective logging. We had a cleanly managed forest. There was some backburning that was done because we were sort of the line between the fire and town there for a while. So there could be a lot of reasons why. But I will tell you that if and when people can go walk around and see that massive, heartbreaking devastation, not just for people, but all the wildlife. And you look at the forests that were well-logged, well-managed, and those that were not, there's no arguing. There's just no arguing. And one of the issues going on right now is that, you know, for instance, our property up there, we have a natural spring with clean water. We have a sewer system that has been operating ever since we've been there for 50 years. And there are other landowners around the valley. We're all fighting really hard to make sure that the recovery is locally based. You know, why can't we put people in Greenville? And I understand the residents that are displaced may need to, you know, there's a lot of factors that play into this. But there are resources and people and energy that still exist in Indian Valley. And we've got to make sure that recovery effort is based in Indian Valley. The leaders controlling this need to be there. Let's not put them over in some other big town where they can take a bow and get a promotion because they had a photo op, right?
Well, and let's also make sure that it doesn't become, you know, oh, this looks like it used to be a town once upon a time. Because we've all driven through those places too.
Yep, yeah. So what's going to happen as we go forward? It's just, you know,
I think it's interesting how many industry people are up there. As I'd mentioned to you the other day, you know, Randy Pugh, dealt with him in our past life when we were in the timber business, and he is a superior businessman and really, really smart in the logging industry. And he's up there in Greenville, and then all of a sudden there's someone with some historic preservation background. I'm like, How interesting. I mean, I've been to Greenville a million times. I had no idea who was living there, apparently. Let us take a really quick break, and then we're going to come back with our guest, Tanya Comas. And you're listening to We the People. You can find out everything about this show at wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them when they move into your neighborhood? They take over, but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them?
Of the right era, the wrong industry, but you know, that's kind of how all those little towns were. You know, the industry was the town, and Greenville was absolutely a logging town.
Absolutely. If you're okay with it, I would like to kind of segue from forests to some of what the Nonprofit Foundation does, and there is a very strong link between the two in terms of the solutions that we're trying to solve.
Oh, absolutely. We're just following along. We're passengers in the car today.
Okay, excellent. So I guess, you know, overall, if you look at something like, you know, the forests are suffering right now, and cultural resources like Battleship Row, for instance, you know, is mismanagement of that hallowed site also threatened. And I'll tell you some stories about our work over there and in the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, specifically Alcatraz Island in San Francisco, and some of the leadership issues. And I should be very clear, because we are partners of the National Park Service and also the Department of Defense, and I should say very clearly and repeatedly that there are a lot of really good, hardworking people in the Park Service and the Forest Service, and what I'm really referring to here is the leadership, you know, the people who have never actually had to sign the front of a paycheck in their entire career, and they are, you know, avoiding responsibility and taking PR opportunities without really any accountability, you know, long-term accountability. So that's something that we battle quite a bit. And I'm going to mention something right now, and we'll come back to it at the end, but just so that people can see where I'm going. Historic preservation, especially in small communities, maybe, you know, more rural communities, is often regarded as, oh, we don't want that because then the government's going to tell us what to do with our buildings. I do have a degree in preservation, and, you know, I love old buildings. But I will say that there's a lot that goes into that. If local ordinances are written correctly, they absolutely are not necessarily prescriptive. So that's a good thing. Where I want to go with this, though, one of the solutions that I think can help the forests, can help national parks, is to use existing laws. So let's not try to create a bunch of new laws that maybe conflict with old ones. There's a very specific, perhaps even to a lot of people, esoteric little part of the National Historic Preservation Act of 1966. There is a term in that act called the adverse effect. And within that, it basically says that any proposed action to a historic resource or action that was already implemented, if the sort of powers that be decide that it was adversely affected that structure, it can have legal implications. So again, that term adverse effect is already in federal law. Well, there's another term called demolition by neglect. And there's a lot of argument that demolition by neglect is an adverse effect. So let's look at that in a bigger sense. Is forest mismanagement demolition by neglect?
All day and twice
all day long?
And twice during the summer? Yeah.
Right. And, you know, a town like Greenville was not incorporated, does not have a historic preservation ordinance. Oddly enough, though, that law applies to buildings that are listed on the National Register of Historic Places or could be listed on the National Register of Historic Places. Greenville was a historic mining town. I could probably have gotten every building on Main Street nominated to the National Register. So there are laws out there right now, and the issue I have with it is something like demolition by neglect is usually something that the government at many whatever level uses against private developers or private owners. So, for instance, somebody owns an old building that is in a block that's all being, you know, upgraded and higher rents, and they're stuck with this old building. So to circumvent the National Historic Preservation Act, an owner or a developer may just decide to ignore the building long enough that it falls into such disrepair that it has technically been demolished. And then they can go in and make the case that I have to demolish it. So that's demolition by neglect. And that is typically levied against the private sector. What I'm suggesting, and I'm no lawyer, and I'm sure somebody could look this up, I'm suggesting we flip that on its head. And we start looking at elected official decisions that have led to demolition by neglect, and we charge them in the same way that they are charging the private industry. It's a clearly defined, in the historic preservation world, well-known concept. But it's always the thing levied against private. And I really feel like if we're going to have leadership making these kinds of decisions, they should be held accountable in the same way.
Yeah. If you were going to take, like, hanging off the list, you know, that would be the second thing people clamor for the most when all this stuff is going on. Hanging's probably bad. Probably can't do that. But holding them accountable, that's a novel idea.
Right. And, you know, holding them accountable is a big, broad term, right? How do you do that? Do they, I'll give you an example, and I have to always be a little careful because there are excellent people in the National Park Service. There are a few leaders that have not fulfilled their responsibilities, and unfortunately, our nonprofit foundation doesn't necessarily pay the price, but the military people who have signed up to do our program have. So I'll give you a little bit of background on the CPI Foundation. I used to teach at Chico State. Believe it or not, there are 4 universities in the country, now 5, that have an entire Bachelor of Science degree in concrete.
Isn't that wild?
it's a technical degree, typically in the College of Engineering or Construction, depending on the university, with a minor in business. So it was really something that the concrete industry got behind and helped fund and gave money to universities and said, you guys know how to develop curriculum. We need people who know concrete and how to manage it, how to manage the companies and the logistics and you know, everything that goes into it. So I taught and ran that program for 10 years and ended up kind of de facto becoming an expert in concrete repair. There was an interesting thing that happened in the last recession, the 2008 era, where not a lot of money was being put into new infrastructure, you know, by Caltrans or other federal, you know, federal highways or whatever. And so a lot of repair started to happen. when there wasn't money to build new, you fix the old stuff.
Yeah, true.
But there was a real lack in the industry of any kind of, number one, enough people that knew how to repair concrete, because it's very different than putting down new concrete. And there were no industry standards. So that led to the certification for concrete repair that I helped work on with some other very, very smart people. So the three legs of the CPI Foundation are military service members seeking training for when they get out so they can get a job. There's infrastructure, and then there's the parks. So let me start with the military service member part of it. We trained military veterans for several years at Alcatraz, and then in 2016, the Department of Defense approached us to start training active duty servicemen members in their final six months of service. They could apply to do our program. And so we were one of the first approved programs by DOD to do this kind of training. So they report to us 12 weeks full-time. They are still active duty service members, and they are still paid by the United States Department of Defense while they're doing this training. So think of it as an internship, preparing them for their next career. Why it makes sense to the American taxpayers is while we're training them, they're helping complete major structural repair work in the parks that needs to get done anyway. And we have a lot of industry partners across the country that help support the program because they believe in what we're doing, and they're hoping to hire these young men and women when they come out of service. So when I say active duty, most people are thinking veteran, but we're actually training them prior to getting out.
Which is great.
In our experience, yeah, in our experience, what we have found after having trained veterans for a certain length of time and then moved on now into active duty is the cliff that a veteran can fall off in terms of, wait, I'm out of service, I'm not wearing a uniform, I don't have a paycheck, and now I'm in an unemployment line. And the spiral downwards, if we can catch them while they are still standing tall, standing proud, ready for their next adventure, get them a job offer before they take off the uniform, the success rate is much higher.
I mean, that there is nothing that would make that a bad idea. Except, you know, not a bad idea, but I guess for you guys, how do you do it logistically?
It's a lot of work, and it takes a lot of work.
I was just thinking about that. I'm like, wait a minute, they're not here. They're not in Alcatraz when they get out. I mean,
no, they're not. But, you know, when you really look at, we work with all military branches, all five, if you count the Coast Guard on top of that. We have just some really good people working with us, and, you know, if they're stationed in Germany or Japan or Hawaii or Alaska, we'll help arrange, you know, if they can get to an Air Force base, they can take a space available Air Force flight to Travis Air Base, and we go pick them up. You know, it's kind of, there's a lot of logistics that go into it. They live in the national parks, There's some old military barracks there, so we are responsible for them 24/7 and responsible to deliver them back to their military base when it's all over. But it's a win-win-win, you know, that the service members getting the training and our goals, that they have a job offer before they finish the program. We work on their resume and interview skills and, you know, okay, where is it you want to live? And is that more important than making a whole bunch of money if you lived over there? Let's work that out.
It's the wraparound services that that everyone thinks we should have, but that no one provides. You guys are doing something that we should be doing as a country, but no one figured that
right.
out.
Right, And we're doing it from a private industry perspective.
Exactly.
You know, we are very accountable to the construction and material supply companies who support us and want to hire these people. So, you know, we are a nonprofit, but we function very much like a for-profit organization with very accountable to our stakeholders. You know, and when you talk about sort of moving on in the infrastructure part of things, the country's talking about this huge infrastructure bill right now. Well, okay, great. Let's throw a bunch of money at it. Who's going to build it?
Mm-hmm. That's what always happens with these infrastructure things. It sounds great, and then all this money goes out, and everybody looks around and goes, did anything happen by you? No. You? No.
I mean, right. Because it's going to go through levels and levels and levels of government and oversight and planning, and this construction company has to hire that one, and then we have to have this other company involved. And, you know, so every company out there, I don't care if it's construction or the, you know, hospitality industry and whatever, everybody's looking for employees right now. So an infrastructure bill would be great, but we've got to have people to do the work.
Absolutely.
There are anywhere, on average, 250,000 people complete their military service and become civilians every year in this country.
250,000?
A quarter of a million
U.S.
citizens become civilians leaving the military every single year. And we're not doing nearly enough for them.
No. And the vocational rehab, I mean, So anyone who's had to deal with that, you know, just apologize, you know, because there's just nothing good to say about it. Every now and then, people luck out, but more times than not, they're funneled into fields that are, okay, classic example. Guy was a medic, really wanted to get a nursing degree. They said, you probably shouldn't. They forced him to get a barber's license.
Oh, my.
From a school of barberness, whatever that is. I don't know. What are they? Cosmetology, I guess, which just makes me...
Barberness. I like that.
Shut up, Bill. Bill's looking at me. Barberness. You know, barberness. And the place was under investigation, closed down. The guy wound up, you know, from pillar to post, living in a travel trailer in another town, just trying to finish it. But he had all this training as a medic. And so, and that's just one of a bazillion stories. Your program, it's about 8,000% better.
Yeah, and, you know, when we hear of low unemployment rates and how veteran unemployment rates are so low, I don't have the statistics. I've had other people have looked at this, and there's another statistic that is probably more important for a veteran. It's not the initial job they get right out of the service. It's where are they 1 year later? Because so many of them will take the very first job offer they get, even if it's not where they want to live, it's not making enough money to support their family, and it's not, like you were just mentioning, not in their expertise area.
It's kind of like, you know, we have a slot. Here, we'll put you in that one. No thought given.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what do you want to do? What are you good at doing? What would, what would make your life feel? I mean, these are people who've brought value to the country. They should be able to walk away. If they're going to have help on that, they should be able to walk away with something that makes them feel good as well. It's just ridiculous.
Right. And another way to look at that is, you know, I'm sorry, were you?
I was going to say, Travis is in there waving his arms. We shut off all the lights in here because it just felt like we were getting interrogated. So we're all working in the dark. But I could see his arms moving. So he's either landing a plane or it's time for a break. I'm guessing break since I don't hear any engines. Yeah, give it time. After that barberness, we're probably on the drone list. Barbers don't have drones, so what a break. So let's see. We're chatting here with Tanya. Tanya, how do you actually pronounce your name so I don't do it incorrectly?
It is Tanya Comus.
Comus, okay. Just like it looks, but I thought, people's names are tricky. And I really hope that if people have friends, family, relatives, neighbors, whatever, that are military service members, I really hope that you will pass this information along to them and we'll get a little more specific on how exactly they do that. But I can tell you now, the website is awesome. We have that all linked up. But her site is cpi-foundation.org, and we have all those links on our site. You can find it at wethepeopleradio.us.
You can bet that I stand ready when the wolf growls at the door. Hey, I'm solid. Hey, I'm steady. Hey, I'm true down to the core. And I will always do my duty, no matter what the price. I've counted up the cost, I know the sacrifice. Oh, and I don't want to die for you, but if dying's asking me, I'll bear that cross with honor, cause freedom don't
come free. I'm an American soldier, an American. Beside my brothers and my sisters, I will proudly take a stand. When liberty's in jeopardy, I will always do what's right. I'm out here on the front lines, sleep in peace tonight. American soldier, I'm an American soldier.
When there we were all in one place, a generation lost in space, with no time left to start again. So come on, Jack, be nimble, Jack, be quick, Jack. Sat on a candlestick, 'cause fire is the devil's only friend. Oh, and as I watched him on the stage, my hands were clenched in fists of rage. No angel born in hell could break that Satan's spell. And as the flames climb high.
There you go. Flames climb high.
I know.
Yeah.
All the songs with fire, so many of them. Songs we used to like when we were in high school. It was funny, I was at a fire meeting up in Old Station where they're watching the fire come over the hill, wondering if they're going to be burned out next. And sitting by a couple people that hadn't started yet, and the folks in front of me, the lady said, we were talking about people camping in the National Forest and that they had closed the forest, and she said, I don't even think it'd be fun to camp. She goes, and I said, well, you know, they wouldn't let them have campfires or anything. She goes, I would never have a campfire again. She goes, the smell just reminds me of summer. I hate it.
That's pretty sad.
Yeah, you know, you live in rural America when the smell of a campfire reminds you of summer. Ugh. All right, Tanya, now where?
All right. Well, we were talking a little bit about infrastructure.
Yes.
And the need for, you know, if we're going to have an infrastructure bill, that we're going to need workers to do it. That's, you know, it's one goal of our small foundation is, right, train some people who will want to go into those types of jobs. There's also some interesting background. And again, I'm linking this right back, at least in my mind, that, you know, it's management of forests or management of infrastructure or management of historic buildings and who is responsible and what's really getting done. I promise when I go off on this little tangent, it will link back to infrastructure.
Okay, we love tangents.
I'm already playing it in my head.
Okay. Pointe du Hoc, Normandy, France. It was the D-Day landing site between Utah and Omaha beaches. I took some students over from Chico State in 2008 and 2009 as part of a project headed by Texas A&M University. And the issue there is the German command post at Pointe du Hoc was critical to the success of D-Day. The cliff had been eroding and the structures, the concrete, the German concrete structures at the top, were being threatened. And so I was the sort of the concrete repair person, and there were a lot of other geophysics and technical engineers from Texas A&M. That is actually what led to the program at Alcatraz and on to Pearl Harbor and the active duty training program. But I became very fascinated with Eisenhower as one of my all-time heroes, both General Eisenhower and President Eisenhower. His brilliance in logistically winning World War II is something he brought back to the United States. And as of him becoming President Eisenhower, we didn't have a U.S. interstate system in this country, partly for defensive reasons. It was important to him that you could get equipment, people from one coast to the other in the case of a war, because he experienced in Europe you couldn't get from point A to point B with tanks. So a lot of our interstate system, the system of the roads, the numbers of the roads, the way that they're organized was national defense. Along with commerce, because, you know, the world was coming back out from under the cloud of World War II at the time. So if you look at that, all of our infrastructure is that old. And that's the reason everybody's all up in arms about it now. But back to the idea of concrete or national forests being something that, that you can just sort of manage from afar and hope it doesn't happen on your watch. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Concrete doesn't fall apart, right? Forests will be fine, or we just don't let them burn, or we let them burn, or we do whatever. So that, do you have any questions there? It sounded like somebody had a question.
No, we were just...
Oh.
Those were random government noises that there were the little helicopters that live inside the wires.
Got it. I listened to one of your guests from about a year ago, and I will mispronounce his last name, but Ray Haupt.
Yeah, Ray Haupt. Yeah.
Okay. And I wrote down a quote that he said. He said, "The knee jerk is always 20 years behind."
Yep.
Yeah, that's,
and I
that's
thought
right.
that was perfect.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, people have seen this for, I mean, gosh, you know, the Forest Service, the retired, he's part of the, I think he said that in that show several times, he's part of the retired Forest Service employees, the retirees group, he always refers to it as, and still a registered professional forester. All those folks have said for such a long time, they said, you know, we're either going to change this policy, make a radical change in the policy, or we will have no forest in 40 years. And I guess at this point, I'm thinking 40 years is kind of optimistic.
Yeah, that's very optimistic when you're burning down a million acres in one fire.
Right. And we have politicians and federal department leaders who are betting that it won't happen on their watch.
Yeah, because that's a great criteria, right? Not that it won't happen. It just won't happen while they're holding the reins of the buggy. Well, and the guy who's responsible for Region 5... The Forest Service Region 5, which is, you know, consistently in flames, and they've spent a lot of time managing fires. Like I think of Happy Camp all the time. They had a fire up on the hill, and they watched it for, I think it was 4 days, could have been longer, but people in town were like, hey, there's a fire, we're like right there, it's right there, right above the town, you can see it, it's right on the hillside, visible for everybody. And they said, yeah, we're keeping an eye on it. And they said, well, you know, the wind comes up, and, you know, we really probably shouldn't let that just sit there. And sure enough, wind came up, became a massive fire. I forgot the name of it. It was a few years ago. But they literally watched it until it exploded. And we've all heard those stories. Anyone who lives out here has heard those stories. And that guy's now the chief of the Forest Service, the guy promoting that policy. He's the chief of the Forest Service. They put out an edict that said they needed to... I really should have gotten it before we came on, but here's my paraphrase, that they were going to stop doing fire management, they were going to do fire suppression as long as it was safe. It had a bunch of caveats that basically said, so we're going to keep doing the same thing we were doing.
Wow.
So much for that.
Right. Well, and I'll link that right back to where I do have a little more expertise, which is in, you know, in the national parks with the, you know, all the cultural resources. You know, we've had a very successful program in the Golden Gate Natural Recreation Area, like I said, at Alcatraz for many years. We expanded to Pearl Harbor. If you've never been to Alcatraz, I encourage you to go.
I've been like 15 times, so I've seen your work.
Oh, there's some things that you haven't seen.
I've seen where your work needed to be. How's that?
Right. Well, it's a 22-acre island of all concrete structures.
And yeah.
There's every type of deterioration there, every construction system there. Some interesting things like, you know, what do you do when... So the military built all of that. Not everybody knows that, but... The cell house on Alcatraz was the largest reinforced concrete building in the world when it was built.
Wow.
By the United States military. So it had been different uses over the years by the military, but by the time it became military prison, it was mostly built by prison labor. So there's some very curious, you know, if you think that prisoners probably aren't highly motivated to build a strong building, right?
You would think they wouldn't be, but you know.
Right. No, it was actually really well built. So because of that, there were conversations with, so the National Park Service also runs the Pearl Harbor National Memorial. And if you've been there, most people go to the visitor center and then take a boat ride over to sea and go on to the memorial that sits on top of the USS Arizona that is still submerged. And it's a, you know, it's the resting place for a lot of American heroes. What people may or may not notice, and I encourage you to notice it if you go, anybody else, is as you're on that boat ride, as you look up and down to the left and to the right of the memorial, there are these massive concrete structures that look like islands all in a line. And they were built when the United States knew that entry into World War II was probably imminent, and they wanted to move the rest of the U.S. fleet from San Diego to Hawaii, but there wasn't enough berthing spaces. So they built these massive, essentially concrete islands on these enormous precast concrete piles that were pounded into down into bedrock so that there was a place to dock all the warships. Mm. And they were tied bow and stern to each of the two mooring quays, and then another ship was tied outside of those. So from a landmark, it's the highest level of a landmark that the United States bestows upon a place, which is a National Historic Landmark, an NHL. But as a national park, again, I want to be very clear that there's a lot of great people in the National Park Service we're talking about.
It's okay. I know a lot of ones that aren't great. I've given you phone numbers of people who are great, however. And
right,
I think they're in charge of that, which is awesome.
Well, let me give you an example. So we signed our contracts with the National Park Service and with the Department of Defense over there in 2016. 2021, we still have not started the project.
Oh, dear God.
5 years. Mm. And, you know, and that really kind of came down to concrete doesn't fall apart. This is too big for so many people to even wrap their heads around.
That's kind of the interesting part to me is that we've all seen concrete deteriorate, but mm-hmm. you don't think about it being able to be kind of rehabbed. You think, well, I guess you got to take it out and do it all over again. But that's obviously not how that works. We're kind of winding into the tail end of this hour. I don't want you to get started and have to cut you off, because I really think this is the interesting part, because all of these monuments, sure. we want to keep them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to come back with our guest, Tanya Comas. This is all about veterans, infrastructure, and national parks, kind of how they all intertwine. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Heart and soul in the bone box, and I can feel that muddy water running through my veins, and I can hear that lullaby of the midnight train.
Welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pap A Machinery.
3119 Twin View Boulevard.
Hold on now.
Oh, sorry.
Now, just hold on. You're walking all over my ad here. Pap A Machinery is our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer, And if you need a mower, a tractor, implements, part service, they do it all up there. Go up and see them. They're at 3119 Twinview Boulevard. Thank you.
That was my part.
Thanks, Aaron. And or give them a call at 226-9226 or catch them on the web at papaymachinery.com. And they also still have a few Honda generators if you're looking for a generator for standby power. And they have a pretty good inventory of steel products. So go up and see them.
Yeah, hurry up before they get rid of all the gas-powered everything in California.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that's going to work out well. Hey, so on a serious note, there was a post on Facebook, which usually is like, oh, okay, I couldn't care less. But someone sent this to me, and I thought, you know, this really should be shared because there's a lot of, well, okay, I think in the scope of news these days, it's 99% bad. I think that's what news is. It's like bad news. This was really a different little look at the fire up there in Greenville. So I don't know who the guy was, but he says, to say going back to Greenville for the first time was difficult would be an insult to my hometown. It was soul-shattering, life-changing. And as I looked over the land where my town once stood, I felt the little bit of hope that I'd been holding on to slowly fade away. I'm one of the lucky few. My home is still standing. Somehow, despite the odds, I was able to walk through my front door this week. And as I did, I found this letter. A letter from one of the firefighters, the brave firefighters, who risked their life that night. I knew they had replaced my flag, but reading this restored some of my hope. Hope for our nation and hope for our community. And I'd like to share it with you all. The note said, "Dear homeowner, my name is Jay, and I'm an operations branch director for the California Federal Incident Management Team 4. On the evening of August 4th, as the Dixie Fire came through the town of Greenville, I was leading firefighting forces that had responded in an attempt to save as many structures as we could. Fire conditions were extreme, to say the least, and the environment that we were operating in was equally hazardous. When we arrived in your neighborhood, the fire conditions had created 65-mile-an-hour winds and a large ember storm. The fire was well established around the homes, and the conditions were deteriorating rapidly. As Cruz and myself fought to push the fire back off the homes, I observed through all the embers the wind, your flag flying stoically against the destruction unfolding around us. Your flag served as a morale booster for so many of the brave men and women out here working to save your homes. Many of those men and women were military veterans that had served our country prior to becoming firefighters, and for them the flag had additional significance. Around 20-45 hours, fire behavior escalated to an unprecedented level with yet another ember storm and 60 to 70 mile an hour winds. While we held our ground, it was at that point that I retrieved your colors rather than allowing them to be destroyed. For 2 days, your flag rode with me, folded and safely protected in my command vehicle as conditions were still extremely fragile. I wanted your return to your home that is still standing to be emphasized by a new flag that is still standing and flying proudly. I hope that this new flag can symbolize the pride and strength of your community and the determination and resilience of our firefighters. I also wanted your old flag that you flew so proudly in front of your home and over your community and our great country to honor Greenville and the horrible tragedy and hardship that it has endured. My team and I would like the nation to know the pride and strength of Greenville and its residents like yourself who live there. It is because of that that your flag is on its way to Washington, D.C. to be flown over the U.S. Capitol building in honor and respect of your community and the strength and resilience of Greenville and our great nation. Your old flag is not mine to take. It belongs to you, and it will be returned to you. For now, I want your colors to continue to fly proudly over Greenville, California, and American soil. Please feel free to contact me or a liaison officer with any questions or concerns. Thank you for your patriotism to our country and for giving all of us out here that night, fighting to save everything we could, a symbol and colors to fight under. Yours respectfully, Jay, OPS Branch 25.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It also, there was also like a little P.S. The flag we're flying once belonged to my grandfather. It's a flag that flew in front of his old home for years. He was a 30-year Air Force veteran and proud American. It was pretty, can you imagine you come home, your house isn't burned down. That's pretty great, but your town's gone, and then you find that note. It's like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, Tanya.
Incredible.
Yeah.
I'm a little choked up. I'm gonna
yeah, it's like, okay, now back to the world. But I thought, gosh, I don't want to run out of time and not share that, because that says a lot. It says a lot about the people in Greenville. It says a lot about how people felt about trying to save it. And sometimes these things look really mechanical, you know. Oh, great, it's a fire. Here come the firemen, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Everybody just goes through the paces. And it's not really like that. It's much more, there's a lot more emotion than that involved for the people who live there, the people that are trying to save the place and everything else. So I think it's...
As we drove up the hill to the house that I grew up in, which is like the person who posted that, we were extremely fortunate that it survived. The flag is still flying there. And as we sat on the front porch, there's one young doe that just has been hanging out on the front lawn, and there's one fire truck still sitting up there covered in pink fire retardant, but this little deer keeps hanging out by the fire truck, and we finally all figured that perhaps the firemen were feeding her.
Oh.
Because she's not scared of us, and we're so far out of town. So that little doe is now named Dixie, and we just watch her every day in amazement.
Well, the other thing too is I'm sure she figured, you know, it was kind of like magical. There was no fire by the red trucks.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, follow the red trucks.
So, yeah.
Oh, that's pretty. That's awesome.
Yeah, pretty amazing. Well, us and the other people who were fortunate, everybody is, you know, ready to open hearts and homes and water systems and whatever's needed to help the community come back. You know, we've got to keep fighting to make sure it stays local, though. That's a really important one for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you want to go now?
I don't know. There, I feel like
concrete doesn't seem very in the face of all that. Although I will say,
because all those things don't get saved without folks like you who understand how.
Right.
Pearl Harbor, Alcatraz. I mean, honestly, I remember years ago, because I started going to Alcatraz with, you know, relatives who moved out here or came out to visit when we moved out here. And, you know, let's go to Alcatraz. It was like, oh, Aaron could take them. Great.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lot better. Bill had never been, even though he lived down there for a long time. And when did we go to Alcatraz? It's been like maybe 15 years ago. But it was looking really hammered. Like in the early 80s, it's looking a lot better, mm-hmm. You know, in recent years. And it sounds like, how long have you been working on that? How long has that project been ongoing?
Since I started down there just in the summertime in 2010. And we have been, that was just an informal program I started. And then it became a year round in about 2014. We've been there year round. We do three teams a year, 12-week teams each year, of military people. So I think you mentioned it earlier. If someone listening has a service member getting out and would like to do some training, you know, the construction industry, we work to get them their jobs, but it's not just, you know, being on a construction crew or mixing concrete in a plant. They're, you know, the construction is such a major part of the United States economy. They need drivers. They need scientists. They need accountants. They need, you know, front office workers. They, you know, it's an enormous industry, so it's not just.
Yeah, you guys aren't just kind of like a fancy day labor force. I mean, you're helping people
absolutely
actually find real careers. And
right, our primary focus is the military service member. We do projects and parks as the training, but our and another thing that we do, and I think we touched on this earlier, we do not. The service members who do our program do not have to touch their GI Bill benefits. That's a core value to this nonprofit foundation, is they get to maintain their GI Bill benefits for use once they get out in some other training, and they can actually now transfer them to their spouse or children.
Oh, that's awesome.
So if that service member, you know, does a program like this and lands in a job that they love and doesn't need it, they can pass that on forward. So we rely a lot.
Yet again,
on
you've sidestepped the bureaucracy. Good thinking.
Yes, exactly.
Good thinking, because exactly, you know, trying to get those benefits lined up with what it is that you're doing and what they want to do. Yeah. Private industry just is so much more nimble. It's so much easier to be responsive.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, you were talking about, you know, how concrete looked at Alcatraz. And one thing that that concrete is a kind of a blessing and a curse is that it is so durable for so long. But unlike wood and other building materials that may show their distress sooner on the exterior, most of, and this might get a little into the science and technology of it, but it's kind of fascinating stuff. What most of us see as deteriorating concrete, by the time we see it, it's much worse inside of the structure. Mm. And it's essentially not the concrete that's failing, it's the steel reinforcing.
Oh.
So.
Well, that's funny you say that, because I think that's exactly what they're finding in Florida with that big condo collapse, that it had
absolutely
completely decayed on the inside.
Absolutely. There is so much technology now for being able to assess all of that. It's just like any of the infrastructure across the U.S. You need to invest in routine maintenance and investigation to know the condition. I mean, there's ultrasonic pulse velocity and all kinds of technologies that can see right inside of concrete, so that you know what's going on inside.
And how much of that do you think actually goes on with a lot of our infrastructure, bridges and so forth?
Very little, because if you're the taxpayer, you want to see the new road go in, you don't want to see the old one fixed.
Right.
You know, it's a battle, right? So if you think about, here's a way to envision what's going on. We're still making concrete essentially the same way the Romans did. Sand, cement, rocks and water. You know, it's not really that much more complicated, other than present day, we add a lot of chemical admixtures to make it be high strength, lightweight, perform well in freeze-thaw environments or in salty environments by the ocean. The chemicals are added to make it do those things.
Is it true they actually add fiberglass to concrete in places?
Everything is added, you know, for different reasons.
It's like hot dogs.
Fly ash, which is a byproduct of, coal-burning coal industry, is used, and it increases long-term strength of concrete. Slag, which is a byproduct of the steel industry, is used for the same reason. If you go back and look at the great example is the Pantheon in Rome. The walls at the base of the Pantheon, it's concrete, 2,000 years old, are 20 feet thick.
Wow.
And today we build things that are taller or longer span that are a foot thick. The difference is reinforcing.
Mm-hmm.
So the Romans actually understood the performance of concrete enough to know that they needed some kind of reinforcing. So think about it this way. If you have a big, tall concrete column, you could put something extremely heavy on top of it, and it's not going to crush the concrete. And here's a good visualization of that. If you took one square inch of concrete, a little tiny 1-inch by 1-inch by 1-inch cube, and you put a Suburban, you know, a GMC or Chevrolet Suburban, on that one little square inch, it wouldn't crush it. That's the compressive strength of concrete. If you took that same, if you took a big long column and you put it on its side and put each end on top of a post, it doesn't do as well in that situation. And that's because concrete can more easily be pulled apart than it can be pushed together.
Decompressed.
So the Romans realized that if we want to build really tall walls, they can't be really thin, because if the wind hits it, they're not going to survive. So they just built them massively thick. They actually tried to reinforce their concrete with bronze, which was the metal technology they had. But as it turned out, bronze and concrete had different rates of expansion and contraction, which cracked the concrete. So they understood the need for reinforcing 2,000 years ago, but didn't have the technology to do it.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And it is
amazing.
Like, you look at the Appian Way, and that's rock. I don't know if they mix it with concrete. I'd be curious what you think about that, because actually the Appian Way, driving on that, was like the smoothest road ever, and I mean, the Romans made that. Like,
yeah.
Maybe they could
for chariots.
Work. Maybe they could come to work for Caltrans.
Yeah.
She does work with Caltrans, too, by the way. I read about that. We'll be right back and learn about that. Maybe you can tell us a little about that, too, and how that works. I know up here, too, we're changing some of our, especially in the areas that have heavier snow load up by Mount Shasta and in the canyon up there, they are replacing the asphalt roadways with a concrete highway. So I think they're looking at, gosh, it's fun fixing these every year, but maybe we could just do something really good that lasts for a long time.
Yeah.
Clever idea. We'll be right back. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Bang, tell you what you do. Call them a rain. Some douchebag rises up and overthrows his government. Diplomacy ain't working. And ammo's all been spent. The world is in a crisis, and the media's a curse. I'll tell you what to do when it goes from bad to worse. Call a Marine, instead of 911. They're built to improvise, adapt, and overcome. When you're in knee deep and you're up shit's creek, you've tried everything. Tell you what you do. Call a Marine. This big dog will fight when you rattle his cage. And you'll be sorry that you mess with the U.S. of A. 'Cause we'll put a boot in your ass, it's the American way. Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list. And the Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist. And the eagle will fly, and it's gonna be hell when you hear Mother Freedom start ringing her bell. And it'll feel like the whole wide world is raining down on you. Courtesy of the red, white, and blue.
Okay, so my hope is that every radio station in the country just starts playing that song endlessly, and then accidentally someone in the White House hears it and feels motivated by it. Enough said.
I'm with you.
Yeah.
Yep, there you go. And we'll end it there. We could also play that for the State Department. I've got several departments I'd like to play it for. None of the guys you work with, though, you know, no Caltrans, no national parks, they're all good. We won't get you in any trouble. But you do consulting work with all of these different people, too. It isn't just historic preservation that you do, right?
Oh, no, absolutely not. In fact, that's just it's really how I ended up coming into the concrete world. You know, repair is not just about historic buildings. It's about, you know, all the infrastructure and that kind of thing. And most of the work I've done has involved, I've always had a training focus along with what I do, so it's either with college students or with the people training from the military and our foundation that have done different projects. One that we did that was fascinating, and I'm hoping that somewhere down the road it picks back up with, this is again another tangent, but it's quite interesting. In NASA's space program, they have technology to convert the CO2 that astronauts breathe out to usable oxygen on a spaceship. NASA, as a federal agency, has to prove when they go to Congress for their funding that there is an Earth application. It's easier for them to get funding for research if they can show that it has, you know, that the rest of us get the benefit somehow other than, wow, it's great that we're going to outer space. Well, NASA identified the concrete industry, specifically the cement industry. So concrete and cement, not the same thing, right? Cement is the gray powder that goes in and mixes with sand, rocks, and water to make concrete.
Mm-hmm.
But NASA identified the cement industry as a good partner, mainly because of the CO2 produced in the manufacture of cement. 5% of the world's CO2 is a factor of cement production worldwide.
No kidding.
Now, everybody loves to scream about, well, concrete's bad then. Concrete's bad. We need to use asphalt, which is really beneficial to the big oil companies. And we can't use concrete, though. Well, let me give you the facts on that. If half of that 5% is the power needed to heat cement that creates the cement process. The other is a chemical reaction. When you take a limestone rock, you crush it, burn it, and go through the steps, it comes out the other end of a kiln as cement. But cement is only roughly 11%, give or take, of a mix of concrete. The rest is local sand, rocks, and water, typically. When you look at the sort of cradle-to-grave life cycle of that, concrete is a very sustainable material for how long it lasts, the big percentage of the rest of the materials that are local. So, you know, you'll often hear arguments that cement is terrible, and we all envision all of the big concrete that we see out there having produced CO2, and that's not the case. It's only the gray powder part. So it is actually in the overall view a very durable product and one of the best taken as a whole for, you know, CO2 levels, if that's your interest.
Yeah, it's interesting because we're always debunking something. Never fails. We're told all sorts of, you know, just ludicrous lies that, look at the fires. Look at forest fires. I was thinking about that a couple of weeks ago, and I realized, you know, we talk about tornadoes and hurricanes and all these things as natural disasters. Fire, natural disaster. It's like, mostly an engineered disaster. We've done that one on purpose. And if we allow that to become a natural disaster because of climate change, because that's what they want it to be, it's all caused by climate change. So if everybody gets out of their car, nothing will burn down again. It's like,
right.
Yeah, okay. Well, those,
no, yeah.
Doesn't
that's
really.
That's a management plan.
That's why I played Ray's show again. We
right.
did that show in October, and I think I played it in February, and I played it again a couple weeks ago because, honestly, we just can't let people be dumb about this stuff. So do the thing.
Right.
Give us the okay, so someone says, well, concrete's bad for the environment. It creates a bunch of CO2. What's our answer again?
Concrete doesn't create CO2. Cement production does. But it's such a small part of concrete. And it is so durable and lasts so long that the percentage, I'm not giving you a very good elevator speech for that.
No, it's pretty good.
Taken in a nutshell, the long-term durability of concrete, the small percentage of concrete that is the cement portion, which is the only part that produces CO2, it is an extremely environmentally friendly solution.
See, that's easy.
The only solution otherwise is just don't build anything.
Right? Yeah, right.
You know, we're not over our national obsession with building stuff, so... You know, and you mentioned the road being, you know, over Lake Tahoe, Interstate 80 over Tahoe, is also over Donner Pass, has also been redone in concrete.
Oh.
And, you know, the reason for that, and like you mentioned in your area, is it's just so much more durable.
Well, they have the plows.
Heavy truck traffic with
yeah, they've got all the plows, they've got all this stuff, and, you know, the asphalt is just, it's funny because I grew up in Connecticut, and we did a lot of shoveling because... You know, we were the Irish Catholic kids, so we didn't have snowblowers. We had shovels. I think that's why our parents had so many children. That was the rumor anyway. I was a kid with a shovel. Pretty good. But we did, there was this one lady, Mrs. Fetterhoff, and Mrs. Fetterhoff's driveway was asphalt. She was the only one with an asphalt driveway, and it went to her garage was in the back of her place. And that asphalt driveway was like a puzzle. So every winter you had to go shovel Mrs. Fetterhoff's puzzle. And if you got too close to the pieces of the puzzle, they chipped out and you had to get them all fit back in there because it was asphalt.
Yeah, asphalt is
right.
not
the concrete
permanent.
Driveways were like, whoosh, 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 you know, and you were done.
Right.
It was a million percent better.
Yeah. Well, and then on top of that, you know, every industry hopefully is innovative. And you know, the concrete industry, you know, we touched on the idea that it's the typically – the steel reinforcing inside the concrete that starts to rust or technically corrode. And when that reinforcing inside of the concrete that's there to make it withstand lateral forces and tension and all these other things, otherwise it would have had to be 20 feet thick, when that steel starts to corrode, it expands and that starts to crack the concrete from the inside. So by the time you're seeing the spalling and the little rust marks on the corners, especially of concrete structures, chunks start to fall off, and then more moisture gets in and causes more corrosion. You know, for instance, glass fiber reinforced concrete is now a new solution. We use that on historic buildings. We're using it. It's fairly new in the industry, but you can substitute steel reinforcing with glass fiber reinforced or other systems that include fibers, so tiny little fibers all mixed throughout the concrete matrix. So there's a lot of innovation going on that will take the steel corrosion and even ways to use steel and keep it from corroding. So it's really not that concrete is deteriorating in our infrastructure across the country. It's you know, sometimes it's the workmanship of when it went in. Sometimes it's not designed well to begin with. Most often it's steel corrosion that causes the damage, but there's a lot of innovation going on around solving that. And I would also mention, if this is at all fascinating to people out there and you have kids looking at college, Chico State has one of the only 5 university majors in concrete. It's called Concrete Industry Management, or CIM. Like I said, it's a technical degree along with a business degree with heavy support from the industry. And I would definitely encourage, if you have, you know, kids looking at college in that region, it's Chico State was chosen for this program to represent the West Coast. By the industry. And really, there's a lot of reasons for that. One is, you know, the industry was really interested in state school, hardworking, you know, a little more interested in application than, you know, the big R1 research theory-based universities. So it's a very, very high success rate in job placement, job retention, and it's pretty awesome for a college student to go and get a degree that is so applicable and so connected with the industry.
Yeah, since a lot of them are, you know, I mean, not really all that helpful. I won't name any. I have some in mind. Lesbian studies.
Well,
but anyway, that was just
we could go into that. I taught at university for 10 years and that was enough.
Yeah, so you know all about the degrees that really weren't all that helpful.
Well, you know, there's a lot of battles. You know, I think there's a lot of good arguments on either side, but there were those in academia who argued that something disapplicable didn't belong in a university.
Oh, you're kidding.
And, I fought some major battles there on that front. One of my responses, we're housed in the College of Engineering, and one of my responses was, well, our students are getting jobs paid more than a lot of the engineers are getting, and they're getting promoted faster. They're managing the projects that your engineers are working for. Not that engineering is a bad field. They're both very good. But, you know, it's a highly technical, highly business-oriented. It's a huge shaker and mover and shaker in the U.S. economy. So it's, you know, it's going strong. I would encourage people to check it out.
That's really cool.
Wow, that is.
Tell me this. What about what about dams? I mean, because we, you know, I fight a lot about the removal of the dams upon the Klamath, and excuse me, they're, you know, the other side. How about that? My sister says I'm a name caller, so you know, I guess I'm finding myself editing what I say. It's really. I have these long pauses with myself.
I was gonna say that.
Okay, the haters who are stupid and just, you know, will say things like, "Well, these dams are all antiquated and they have to come out." And I've read more than one place. Maybe you can verify for me that these huge concrete dams take like 100 years to cure.
There's a lot of interesting ways that is managed. You know, if you look at the Grand Coulee or the Hoover Dam are two of the biggest, the way that those, yes.
I mean, it takes a really long time, so just because they're old doesn't necessarily make them antiquated.
No, certainly not. And they can be added on to and you know, upgraded. You know, concrete's a great, I hate to use the word flexible with concrete, but where it can, you know, let me get back to your question about 100 years to cure. Theoretically, concrete never stops curing.
Oh.
Theoretically. Okay. You could find some cement grains within, you know, any concrete structure that never came in contact with water. So imagine if you take dirt off the ground and mix it with water, you get a mud paste, right? And when that, really the water's just evaporating out eventually, and then you end up with crumbly dirt again. Cement works very, very differently than that. The way cement is made, you take limestone rocks, which are calcium carbonate, used to be at the bottoms of oceans, seashells.
Mm-hmm.
So you take calcium carbonate rocks, which is limestone, they crush them up, put them through a massive kiln. Even a small one is about the length of a football field, and it's on a tilt. It's a big round cylinder in these rocks, and this go tumbling down through. They get heated to 2,700 degrees, and that's where CO2 is lifted off, and these little rocks come out the other end of the kiln called clinker. They look like little black balls. And then those get ground up, and that is what we know of as cement. It's also mixed with gypsum and other things. So cement is the gray powder of cement. When you mix that with water, it's not just water getting mixed in and then drying out. When water hits a cement grain, it undergoes a chemical reaction. And that is what produces its strength.
Mm-hmm.
And the more that you can keep the water in the concrete, like you might have seen somebody sprinkling a sidewalk with water after
yeah.
they've placed it down, or putting plastic over it. The whole point there is to not let the water evaporate. You want the water to react with the cement grains that produces the strength. Well, theoretically in a lab, every grain of cement has hit some water and is a part of that structure. In the real world, you know, we don't have the perfect mixing technology to really make that happen. So if you have, you know, a dam, a massive concrete dam, concrete at the center of that dam is going to take a very, very, very long time to go through its complete reaction, because there's also heat given off, and if it's trapped deep inside, the heat can't be given off. But the fact that it hasn't cured completely 100 years later has nothing to do with the strength. They reach the strength within however long they were engineered to early on in their construction.
Sure.
But it's kind of an interesting sequence of events. And another kind of cool way to think about this is, so we took limestone rocks, we burned them, released CO2 into the atmosphere, not that much in the grand scheme, and then we mixed that cement with sand, rocks, and water, and we created a concrete dam. Nature has this really funny, over time, concrete wants to reabsorb CO2.
Oh.
And turn back into limestone. It's a natural process. Now, it's not that concrete is the solution to a CO2 problem, because it can't absorb that much that fast.
That's provided we think there's a CO2 problem.
Exactly.
Yeah, we should probably add that in.
There have been those, you know, early on when that realization was really, hey, we can, you know, concrete is the solution, and it's really not. But I bring that up because it's man-made stone.
Yeah.
That's what we're creating with concrete.
And does that absorption of the CO2, does that make the concrete harder?
It does, but it also, it's a complicated reaction, because if there is steel reinforcing, it can actually accelerate, it's called carbonation. Hmm. It's reabsorbing CO2. It depending on the concrete mix and the circumstances, it does add a little bit of strength, but it can also cause other issues, like it can make the steel reinforcing corrode faster. There's a lot of steps in there I'm not going through, but carbonation in an unreinforced structure is not necessarily a bad thing.
Hmm. Wow.
Carbonation in a structure that has steel reinforcing is a contributing factor, or can be, depending on other circumstances.
Doesn't that give us all a little bit of...
Yeah.
A few extra tools in our tool shed. There's nothing,
well,
you know,
like,
there's nothing like
concrete.
It. You know, they come after you with this stuff, and it's like, oh, man, I never thought about that. I don't know.
Right.
You know, and this is one of those, like, now we're always smarter.
Right.
We have to take a really quick break. We're going to come back with our guest, Tanya Wattenberg-Comas. We're We're talking about all sorts of things we never talk about. I really hope you send this show out to your friends and stuff. I think it's pretty interesting, and I am always thrilled when we find somebody who's talking about something that isn't already, that we didn't already get bludgeoned with all week. Yay! Something new. Something new to expand our minds. So let's see. Today is August 29th, 2021, and you'll be able to find this show commercial-free this afternoon, a little bit later on, at
wethepeopleradio.us.
It's the guts and it's the glory. 100 stripes, 100 stories. It's the Pledge of Allegiance on the 4th of July. It's them handwritten letters from home. It's them sleepless nights alone. It's his newborn baby he left with his wife. Mr. Red, White, and Blue, lay down his life. Mr. Red, White, and Blue, for these stars and stripes. Hey.
I'm a chicken fried, a cold beer on a Friday night, a pair of jeans that fit just right, and the radio. Oh, oh, oh. Well, I was raised up beneath the shade of a Georgia pine, and that's home, you know. Sweet tea, pecan pie, homemade wine, where the peaches grow. In my house, it's not much to talk about, but it's filled with love that's grown in southern ground. And a little bit of chicken fried, cold beer on a Friday night, a pair of jeans that fit just right.
Good one. Travis was inspired. He's like, can we play that one? Like, I don't have it. I'll find it. Kudos to you. That was fun. Oh, so
we were talking about the CO2 factor on concrete. That was very interesting.
I love that. That's very okay. That goes right behind. If CO2 is a pollutant and we're breathing it at 400 parts per million in ambient air, and then we do CPR on somebody and mouth-to-mouth resuscitation actually puts 40,000 parts per million into them if you blow into somebody. So why didn't they all die?
That's a head-scratcher.
That's a toughie.
Stop! You're killing them!
Said no one ever.
Well, you know, I will add something that's another interesting concrete fact, which is, so because of CO2 production, it's very hard to get a permit to build to create cement in the United States.
Oh, really?
Existing plants have had to meet new standards, but a lot of smaller ones have closed down, and a lot of it's now being produced in China with no regulations. And then we ship it all back over here because, you know, again, we either need to give up our habit of building a lot of new stuff or figure out better ways to do it. But just saying not in my backyard is not a solution,
no.
Right?
We have a plant just north of us. What?
Yeah.
5 miles?
Yeah, been to that plant many times. Mm-hmm.
Yep,
Lehigh,
yep.
We love them. Calaveras Cement.
Yeah. Yeah.
Three cheers for Calaveras Cement.
They're a supporter of the CIM program at Chico State, and also I know a lot of those guys, and you know, we've had field trips with our military people in my nonprofit program. They're a good company. So, you know, if we're still going to build things, and we still want to build them out of concrete, there are ways that we can be doing it better right here at home. But, you know, like I said, as long as we're just closing our eyes to the fact that, well, it's all being created in China, and then we have all the CO2 to ship it over here and put it on trucks and beat up the highways, and, you know, are we really solving the problem? Why aren't we just letting those jobs be right here in the United States?
Yeah, no kidding.
And where we have control over quality and, you know, local economic development around those kinds of things. And I think that goes right back to, and, you know, maybe this is the last 10 minutes or so, is, you know, coming right back to a local community like Greenville or any other small town or somewhere that's trying to build, rebuild, or just continue to build. the concrete's a great solution. It survives fires, hurricanes, those kinds of things. And this concept I just heard for the first time, I think actually it's from one of your colleagues. Aaron mentioned the idea of hardened communities. I hadn't heard that term. But, you know, the idea of not only individual buildings that won't burn and by extension, you know, be subject to hurricanes and that kind of thing, but also entire communities. You know, are we going to be able to get insurance for anything in Greenville, Indian Valley, Plymouth County, the North State?
Right. Well, they're already, you know, canceling people's insurance that aren't even near the fire. They're
right.
Just, you know, so, you're close enough. See ya.
So we're going to have to look at new, we're going to have to, I think, in some ways, get, you know, the major industry, and, you know, because I'm really connected to the concrete industry, it's the one where I work the most, but we're going to need data and proof and arguments, not only at the local level, but from private industry to help back it up, that we can rebuild. It's not going to be the historic wood gold rush town that it was, but you can rebuild with character and at the same time safely and with durability on an individual building level and a larger community level. I think it's, and going right back to kind of our heartstrings, you know, there are a few buildings in Greenville where some of the walls are standing. And, you know, let's make sure those walls stay standing, and then we can get some creative people in there and work around them. But there's got to be that sense of connection.
Well, they're making concrete siding and concrete fencing, and I mean they make all kinds
of
stuff.
Well, think of Mike Bobbin. He's a local concrete contractor, and he was
concrete's a fun material. Right.
It was a long time ago. He was making fences out of it. Like they look like wood split rail fences, but they're made out of concrete.
There were concrete ships made.
Oh yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That's right.
It's a fun material because if you think about it, you know, it's a complicated material to work with because think of it as a durable product. Or I'm sorry, a perishable product. You know, mm-hmm. If you put concrete in the back of a concrete truck, you know, you've got to get it point A to point B before it starts hardening. But something like, okay, let's take again, I'm going to keep coming back to Greenville because that's so, it's just so moving and it's so a part of everybody's lives right now. You know, you can, and there's a lot of unreinforced historic buildings all around our area, across the country, the world. You can go in and you can do, and this is where, you know, historic preservation doesn't limit. It actually, if it's done right and people can talk about it in the right way, you can mix old with new. You can go in and put a steel frame on the inside and shotcrete the walls from the inside and maintain that historic character, which makes people still feel that it's their community, but now it's safe. It's going to withstand.
You can do that, yeah. And it doesn't screw up the historicalness, you know?
No. There will be somebody out there who would challenge me on that. I'm happy to argue, make that argument. Absolutely not. Historic preservation doesn't mean standing something still in time, by any means.
Since nothing actually does stand still in time and things decay.
No. Forests don't, buildings don't, communities don't. There are specific areas of historic preservation, the term restoration being one of them, which is, yes, we're going to hold this particular building in time because it has such significance, like Mount Vernon, right, George mm-hmm. Washington's house.
Yeah.
It still looks that way. But no, when you talk about rehabilitation or all these other things within the kind of historic preservation realm, that allows for current uses, creative solutions. It's just getting ahead of it in the right way and being able to use the right term. But for a town like Greenville, if everything is bulldozed up there, and that's, some of us are a little worried about that, you know, we want to make sure that we're aware of the process of how this is going to go down. If all of that is bulldozed and nothing is saved, there's no evidence, you know, what's the new character of that town going to be?
I'm thinking Dollar General.
Yeah. Dollar Store survived.
I mean, you look at our, honestly, you look at a lot of our towns that had downtowns, and then they all turned into just kind of like blah, strip mall, you know.
Mm-hmm.
No character.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well,
that's a pretty cool idea that you could go in and actually set a town up, you know, set up a series of buildings for the long term without changing mm-hmm. the way they look.
Yeah.
On the outside.
And those become the anchor that, you know, your grandfather can say, I bought my, you know, fishing rod there. You know, those are the anchors in the character and the connection to the past. And some new things can go in right next door, but it's the continuity and the change over time that still, it's looking backward and looking forward all at the same time. And we can't just do one or the other. But unfortunately, you know, higher level politicians want a good, clean, single direction.
Right.
And this is messy stuff. It's just messy, 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 and it's going to continue to be messy.
And I think that's a argument in most towns when new development comes in. I mean, do we tear down the old or do we, you know, restore it?
Well, or do you just say, oh, well, it was a period of time that's now over, so all of you people now just go live someplace else.
Well, in rural England, you can't tear a building down. You have to rebuild it. Their building codes over there are like, I mean, they still have houses with thatched roofs because you can't.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of funny. Like in Connecticut, I just was looking on Zillow because I was looking up a couple of places where we used to live when we were kids. So I looked our house up in Connecticut. I kid you not, it's still white with black shutters. It's like it'll be white with black shutters forever because they change nothing. If you start tearing things down, that is considered socially unacceptable. They resist that in the East. I'm surprised you live in the West.
Well, there's a lot of proof for economic development based on historic preservation. You know, it's a bad name as if it's historic, we can't do anything. Well, you know, I choose to see historic preservation as economic development. And, you know, kind of seem very foo-foo here, but it's the human connection.
True. People love to go to places like that. And you love it when you drive into a town. Look at all those towns on along 395 and in through that gold rush area, and you pull into those towns, and it's not like going back in time in a bad way. It's cool.
Right. Yeah.
But even in Greenville, it's essentially that the town is gone, but there's a few buildings, the old sheriff's office, the what used to be called the way station. In my childhood, it was called the Copper Hood.
Is that the building on the corner you said?
That one. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And, you know, it doesn't, you know, if we can all band together up there and really convince the county supervisors to let us speak, be a part of the process, save enough of the heart and soul, and think responsibly about what comes in next. There's a new character and a new life for that town, and it doesn't necessarily have to be all managed and organized from the top down.
Yep. And it doesn't have to look like a...
It has to be economically viable. There's all those things, but it just can't be managed from a long way away by people who don't have a connection.
Right, right. Because it'll never end up the way you want. You're right. You have to manage it locally.
Yeah. I just think it's very, very cool that you guys are doing this and providing jobs with our veterans and just making all of that kind of come together in one place. It's impressive. You also, I was looking here, you're a nonprofit 501c3 foundation, and you take on sponsors to support programs and
absolutely
funding partners and all that. I really hope people spread this around since... I mean, I didn't know there was something like this out there and available, and it's something that will benefit all of our communities, whether we live in a big place or a small place, but especially those of us who really have a heart for the small places.
And if you, if you continue on following on our website, we're actually working with Congress to get this, not that I want it to go necessarily a political route, but we're trying to get as many people on board to get this into many more national parks across the U.S., so the opportunity is bigger and more available to more service members, and it improves our parks.
That is spectacular.
For everybody who uses them, and the output is workforce to fix our infrastructure.
Thank you so much, Tanya Wattenberg-Comas. She is with the CPI Foundation, so it's cpi-foundation.org. And thank you so much for coming on with us today, and we're all smarter for it.
Yeah, great show.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.